Lecture 3, Faith and Reason, Scripture and Nature.
In our introductory lecture, we mentioned two methods of gaining knowledge claims, faith and reason. Now it's time to look at these two methods a little bit more closely. Faith operates by belief. A premise is stated and believed or accepted to be true, usually with the backing of some authority. The second, reason, operates by logical argument from premises to conclusions. In this lecture, we're going to examine these methods and their historical interrelationship. This lecture is foundational. It's going to provide for us a basis for our future lectures. But besides faith and reason, these two methods, there's something else of equal importance that I haven't mentioned yet. Namely, where do the premises that are subjected to them come from? So we need to look at sources as well, two sources of knowledge. The two I have in mind are nature, the natural world, and the scriptures. Nowadays, we would consider these very different kinds of sources, but this was not always the case. We have to assess exactly how the two were used and related to one another. So let's take a look now in this lecture at the two sources, nature and the scriptures, and the two methods, faith and reason. Well, much of the basic Christian understanding of these topics was worked out in the patristic period, that is, the age of the church fathers, the first, say, 5 centuries of the Christian era. The most important figure for Western Christianity is certainly St. Augustine of Hippo. He was born in North Africa in 354 to a Christian mother and a pagan father. What St. Augustine did that makes him so memorable is that he produced a profound and enduring synthesis between Greek philosophical knowledge, that is reason, and Christian belief, that is faith. And in so doing, he created systems and methods that are foundational to Christianity. I can't possibly overemphasize the importance of St. Augustine. His ways of thinking have become fully ingrained into basic ways of thinking fundamental to Western culture. Augustine wrote an enormous amount. Over 5 million of his words survive, and this includes over 100 books, 200 letters, and about 500 of the estimated 8,000 sermons he delivered in his life as a North African bishop. As with all of us, St. Augustine's thought was conditioned by the times in which he lived and by his personal history, so it makes sense that we should start with a little bit of biography. As a young man, Augustine rejected Christianity because its teaching seemed absurd and illogical, and the Bible full of fictions and absurdities. The version of Christianity he received was presumably predominantly from his mother, Monica. Her approach to religion was not an intellectual one. It was predominantly faith-based, but this was clearly inadequate for the young Augustine, who, thinking all Christianity had to be this way, simply rejected it. In turn, he turned to the Manichees. Now, who on earth were the Manichees? Well, the Manichees were a widespread sect, they were particularly popular in North Africa, that rejected reliance on faith in favor of what could be proven by argument. So right there was something to attract the young intellectual Augustine. But more characteristic of the Manichees is their dualism. That is, they envisioned the world as a battleground between two forces, good and evil, light and darkness. The two are mixed in the world and in constant battle. We're going to return to Manichaeanism in future lectures because it's one of those ideas that keeps cropping up again and again for whatever reason down to the present day. But my point is that right from the beginning, Augustine's life was marked by an interest in the relationship between faith and reason. At first, the faith presented to him by Monica and rejected, and the reason presented by the Manichees. Well, Augustine was a teacher of rhetoric and an avid reader. Time and time again throughout his autobiography, The Confessions, he refers to the enormous impact made on him by classical texts, works by Cicero, by Aristotle, by the Stoics, by Plato, and particularly by the Neoplatonists. He knew the classical pagan tradition very well, and he benefited from it. Eventually, he left North Africa and traveled to Rome, where he had heard that students were better behaved. and in 384 accepted a job as professor of rhetoric in Milan. Actually, the students he found there were no better behaved than the ones he left in Africa, but poor guy. While he was there, he went to hear the local Bishop Ambrose preaching. Augustine wanted to hear Ambrose's celebrated rhetorical style, but Augustine found something different happening. He found himself listening to the words and their meaning rather than just the way they were strung together. What he found to his amazement was that Ambrose could interpret passage after passage out of the scriptures in a way that they made sense. Augustine was astonished, and here began his lifelong interest in how to interpret the Bible correctly. Well, to finish Augustine's story, he was eventually baptized at Easter in the year 387. He returned to North Africa, where he became a priest and then a bishop, and continued to be a prolific writer until his death there in 430. Well, with that contextualization in place, let's turn to four points made by St. Augustine in his voluminous writings. These not only became fundamental to Christian theology, but they're foundational, as I've said, to our study. The first point is a very simple one. Simply, that there is a unity of truth. There is not one truth for philosophy, one truth for science, one truth for theology. As Augustine says, and I quote him here, "There is no teacher of truth but God, no matter where it comes to light." Thus, with one teacher, and one who, unlike his human counterparts, is both omniscient and always consistent, there must be a single truth. What's the consequence? Well, if the method of faith tells us one thing and the method of reason tells us another, then that disagreement has to be resolved. If nature tells us one thing and scripture tells us another, then that has to be resolved. We can't sweep these conflicts under the rug. We can't say, oh, well, that's fine for natural science, but faith tells me something different. It doesn't allow what I think is one of the more insipid lines that's sometimes heard coming out of the modern mouth. Well, you believe what you want, I'll believe what I want, everyone's entitled to his opinion. Well, this is a lazy and anti-intellectual cop-out. St. Augustine will have none of it. One God, one truth. The challenge, and Augustine stresses just how difficult this is for fallible human beings to get the truth right. St. Augustine's other points flow from this fundamental unity of truth. Next comes his doctrine of the two books, the book of nature and the book of scripture. In one of his sermons, St. Augustine said, "Let the Bible be a book for you so that you may hear it. Let the sphere of the world be also a book for you so that you may see it." The idea is that God reveals himself to mankind in two qualitatively different ways, by inspiring the sacred writers and by creating the world. We human beings can look at both to learn about God. Now, since both books have the same ultimate author, there can't be any contradictions between them. In other words, truths from the book of nature, what we call science now, cannot contradict with the truths from the book of scripture, that is, theology. Now, you might be saying to yourself by this point, oh, well, this is well and good, but isn't it blindly idealistic? That is to say, surely there have been and surely there are conflicts between natural and theological knowledge, or between knowledge gained by faith and knowledge gained by reason. Of course. And St. Augustine was well aware of this. And that brings us, in fact, to Augustine's third point. Both of the books require careful interpretation. Apparent contradictions arise from incorrect interpretations. And Augustine, in fact, investigated the interpretation of both nature and the Bible. In terms of the book of nature, Augustine pondered at length the reliability of our senses to give us good information. He realized that even though the senses transfer to our minds exactly what it is they're sensing, our minds can be mistaken in the way they interpret the information that comes through the senses. Simply, things are not always what they seem. The real truth of the way things are is not necessarily provided by a simple application of the senses. So reading the book of nature can be difficult. It requires rational analysis. No scientist would disagree with that. Augustine further argued, however, that properly understanding the scripture is even more difficult. And there are several reasons. First, biblical passages can have several meanings simultaneously, a literal, an allegorical, a moral meaning all at once. For Augustine, and this may surprise you, what's the most difficult? The literal meaning. That's the hardest one to get. Well, nowadays, we're quite familiar with claims of biblical literalists, most notably, for example, over the reading of the creation stories in the first two chapters of Genesis. For Augustine, and indeed for all theologians until relatively recent times, literal did not mean, as it means today, the surface meaning, what might be called naive literalism. Instead, what it meant is that an interpretation of a passage in such a way that it maintains its connection to the topic it seems to be describing and assigns meanings to the individual words so that the passage makes sense in relation to other sources of knowledge. We need an illustration for that. Take Genesis 1. The literal topic is clearly the creation of the world. Obviously, the passage can be given analogical and other meanings to speak about morality or God's providence and so forth, but the literal sense must expound something that has to do with the creation of the world. Doesn't say how close it has to be to a surface text. It just has to retain the connection between the text and the obvious subject. Augustine himself labored for years on a literal interpretation of Genesis 1. Why did he have so much trouble? Well, because interpretation is hard. He was not going to be satisfied until his interpretation did two things. Resolved contradictions in the text, for example, between the two discrepant accounts of the order of creation in Genesis 1 versus Genesis 2, and two, provided an account of creation harmonious with both reason and knowledge from other sources. Thus, for example, Augustine's literal interpretation of Genesis denies entirely a six-day period of creation. So Augustine's literalism is far from the naive literalism that we encounter today. So biblical interpretation requires just enough faith to believe that there's some truth hidden in the scriptures, and from that point on requires the assiduous exercise of reason to get at that truth correctly. So principles that Augustine enunciated for biblical exegesis became general principles for Christian theology, and we'll see them again and again in this course. He begins with the assumption, the faith statement, that the Bible has an ultimate, underline ultimate, divine authorship. But this ultimate authorship is partly obscured, he says, behind the human words expressed by the human beings who actually did the writing. In other words, the Bible is inspired, not dictated. Secondly, biblical expressions are accommodated to their audience. This is known as the doctrine of accommodation. We should not expect Scripture to confuse the audience, the original audience, with intricacies of mathematics or astronomy that are far beyond them. That's not its purpose. St. Thomas Aquinas, writing about 800 years after Augustine, would write that, quote, "Scripture speaks according to the opinion of the people." However, we should be able to give some interpretation to any biblical passage to save its meaning by proper exegesis. Well, third, because biblical interpretation is so difficult, our explanations of some particularly troublesome passages can be held only provisionally. Fourth and finally, Augustine notes that it's often easier to prove natural and philosophical propositions than it is to interpret specific biblical passages. We can, after all, do experiments to test natural hypotheses, and we have evidence that St. Augustine himself carried out some simple experiments. He mentions in the City of God playing around with magnets. He also mentions trying to test the classical belief that the flesh of the peacock does not putrefy. So he had a good command of the scientific knowledge of his day concerning astronomy, mathematics, botany, and so forth. So Augustine says, interpretation of biblical passages must be informed by the current state of demonstrable knowledge. Now, this may surprise you, but Augustine was really prophetic when he warned explicitly about the danger of being ignorant or dismissive of demonstrated scientific knowledge. He writes very famously, and I quote, "It is a disgraceful and a dangerous thing for an unbeliever to hear a Christian presumably giving the meaning of Scripture and talking nonsense on these topics. Many non-Christians," he notes, "are well-versed in natural knowledge, so they can detect what he calls vast ignorance in such a Christian and laugh it to scorn. The danger is obvious. The failure to conform interpretations to demonstrated knowledge opens the interpreter, and by extension Christianity as a whole, to ridicule for being unlearned." There's a personal dimension here. Remember that Augustine was attached to the Manichees for almost a decade. How did he reject them in the end? It wasn't Ambrose teaching or reading the Bible that did it. Instead, Augustine rejected the Manichees based on what he had learned of natural philosophy and mathematics. He tells us in the Confessions that Manichean doctrines included several regarding the nature of the world, particularly astronomy. But Augustine was familiar with the writings of the best Greek astronomers and mathematicians, and saw that their writings were much more likely true, better demonstrated, better supported, than what the Manichees were saying to him. "Yet," he writes, "I was expected to believe what the Manichees had written, although it was entirely at variance with the principles of mathematics and the evidence of my own eyes." When Manichean teachers couldn't resolve his questions, the intellectually demanding Augustine left the sect. So, Augustine was aware that knowledge of the natural world saved him from the Manichees and led him on his road to the true faith. Now you might ask, why didn't Augustine just become a mathematician or a naturalist instead of a theologian? Well, this brings us to my fourth general point. He simply considered theological knowledge more important. Secular knowledge, such as natural philosophy, was considered an ancilla, that is, a handmaiden that could assist true religion. Ancilla is the Latin word where we get ancillary in English from. So it wasn't something you would focus on for its own sake, but it could help in true religion. For Augustine, it's better for people with a limited time and intellectual energy, the average guy on the street, right, to get the eternal truths of religion first rather than crowding those out from a preoccupation for knowledge of the finite natural world. In the case of scientific knowledge, Augustine states that it's indispensable, however, for those who want to carry out correct biblical exegesis. His writings show a realization that knowledge of the natural world by revealing the majesty of God assists faith and religious devotion. Well, what about faith versus reason? What we've seen thus far is that Augustine puts a premium on the exercise of reason. Indeed, to those who would prevent people from using reason in religion, he exclaims, "Far be it from God to hate in us that faculty by which he made us superior to all other living things. And may it ever be far from us to believe in such a way that we do not accept or seek out reason. For we would not even be able to believe unless we had a soul that was endowed with reason." Well, what of faith? Augustine certainly doesn't leave that out. In a well-known sermon of his, he recounts a discussion. He tells a little anecdote, a discussion he held with a man who said to him, "Let me understand so that I may believe." Augustine's initial response was, "No, believe so that you may understand." Well, the two opposing Latin phrases used here, credo ut intellegam and intellego ut credam, came to represent the dilemma of where do we start in our search for knowledge? Do we start with a faith statement? Do we start with reason? How do we actually get the ball rolling? Augustine realized that his own journey towards faith required reason. And he recognized explicitly in this sermon that those 8,000 sermons of his could operate only on the understanding, that is, on reason, even though their ultimate goal was to create faith. Thus, he concluded that faith increases by understanding. The exercise of reason is necessary to what he calls recta fides, right faith. But he also recognized that the Manichees went wrong by denigrating faith. As Augustine wrote, quote, "The church demands some things that should be believed, even though they cannot be proven." And this to him seemed better than, I quote again, "the Manichees who laughed at people who took things on faith, promised proofs, and then proposed preposterous inventions in the guise of proofs." Thus Augustine recognized that faith and reason could not be separated, nor could one really be given the priority over the other. They always work together. He finishes his anecdote by saying, "Indeed, we agreed. Understand so that you believe, and believe so that you understand. Reason could not reveal to us, for example, the mystery of the Trinity. But once faith assents to the doctrine, then reason can refine and make plausible the belief. Similarly, faith cannot be gained in more than a tentative and really unsatisfactory way without a foundation that's based in reason. Moreover, both faith and reason are prone to error. But working together, they can prove mutually correcting, helping to attain for us what Augustine called recta fides, right faith, and recta ratio, right reason." So, in Augustine's formulation, faith and reason cooperate incessantly to help us gain right knowledge from both the Book of Nature and the Book of Scripture. Now, Augustine's view is at odds with some modern ideas that faith and reason are opposed somehow, or that the two are segregated into either theological or scientific pursuits. Theology with faith, science with reason. So is Augustine's only a historical perspective that's now lost to the modern world? Well, no, not at all. Let's now do what I'm going to try and do in as many of these lectures as I can, that is, bring our historical discussions up to the present. Let's bring St. Augustine's 5th century formulations up to the present day. In 1998, an important encyclical, that is, a teaching document, was issued by Pope John Paul II. The document is entitled Fides et Ratio, that is, faith and reason, so it's clearly germane to our discussions. Indeed, I should point out that the engagement of faith knowledge with the modern world, particularly the scientific world, was a central interest of the late Pope. Now, I have to say, this fact may come as a surprise to those who hear of papal statements only through the American news media that tends to cater to the lowest common denominator. In other words, theology and philosophy are too hard, and only sex is of interest. But let that be. The document presents views of faith and reason and their interactions that are very similar to St. Augustine's ideas. Indeed, it sketches a very useful history of the relationship between the two in theology. Like Augustine, it emphasizes the indispensability of both and their mutual support. In fact, it calls faith and reasons, and I quote, "the two wings on which the human spirit rises to the contemplation of truth." Given this commitment to both faith and reason, the letter takes aim equally at current trends that neglect either one or the other. First, it defends reason, particularly in a theological context. It condemns a position called fideism. Now, fideism is a blind adherence to faith statements that ignores or even explicitly rejects the application of reason to them. In fideism, faith statements are not subjected to logical development or analysis, or even to the simplest logical test of all, that of consistency and non-contradiction. You may have seen a rather unfortunate bumper sticker that was popular a few years back that read, "God said it, I believe it, that settles it." Well, that's one rather lowbrow expression of fideism. But the encyclical explains rather pointedly that faith statements held without any accompanying reason are flawed and precarious. "It is an illusion," the document reads, "that faith tied to weak reasoning might be more penetrating. On the contrary, faith then runs the grave risk of withering into myth or superstition." Strong words. On the other side, in defending faith, the document expresses the conviction that faith acts as a necessary challenge to reason, spurring it on to ever greater heights and greater accomplishments by proposing to it transcendent truths that unaided reason could not reach and might not suspect actually exist. Now, you might think that at this point, a document written by the highest teaching authority of the largest Christian denomination would inject recognizably Christian creed statements. Interestingly enough, it does no such thing, for the faith statements that run most strongly through the document are not specific Christian doctrines, but rather such things as human life has meaning and there exists an eternal and transcendent truth. These faith statements are seen in the context of the document as central consequences of the Christian message and are taken as propositions needed to guide and to inspire the exercise of reason. So a consequence of this is a criticism of some modern philosophical trends. Here the document becomes very interesting, particularly to historians, because it attempts to chronicle the loss of implicit positive faith statements in academic philosophical discourse and modern culture. One example, radical relativism. The document says that this exists only because of a loss of faith in an ultimate truth towards which we are able to strive, even if we can't attain it, towards which we can strive. This leads to the flawed belief that, quote, truth is born only of consensus and not of a consonance between the intellect and objective reality. Similarly, nihilism, that nothing matters, results from a lack of faith in the purpose, meaning, and thus the value of human existence. Pragmatism, too, is criticized because it's seen only as a fallback position, resulting from a loss of faith in the existence of transcendent ideals that are worth striving for. Most germane to our subject, the validity of scientism is seriously questioned. Now, scientism is a philosophical position that rejects as non-existent all knowledge claims except those gained from the positive sciences. In short, that the sciences themselves can provide absolutely everything there is to know. There's nothing outside, in other words, there's nothing outside the ambit of the sciences. By rejecting the possibility of greater meanings, of aesthetics, and ethics, scientism then has the danger of making the pursuit of science devolve solely into a means of material and economic production, rather than human enlightenment, and, as the document further says, can conflate the technologically possible with the morally permissible. Indeed, the document ends with an address specifically to scientists to continue their work, their important work, while maintaining an openness to what is called the sapiential dimension of science. That is, its ability to contribute to wisdom, from the Latin sapientia, rather than just knowledge. That is, in addition to scientific facts and their applications, to remain aware of ideals, ethics, aesthetics, and meaning. What's interesting to note is that the criticized movements don't actually result from a loss of faith per se, but rather a loss of positive faith. That is, human beings are totally unable to determine by reason whether or not there is a transcendent truth or an objective reality. Strong relativists, nihilists, and the rest make the faith-based claim that there is not. Weaker forms of these groups assert that because it's unknowable by reasoning, it's irrelevant. Thus, to the latter, the encyclical proposes the advantages of faith. Why not just take on faith the existence of a transcendent truth, and that gives you something towards which to strive? To the former group, the strong position of nihilism or relativism, it suggests replacing negative faith with positive faith. Crucial to the papal position is the view that all these trends diminish human ability, human vision, human hope, and human striving, and thus ultimately human culture and human life. The thing that I find really most remarkable about this document is its enormous optimism about humanity. May I say its enormous faith in humanity. in an age where we're much more accustomed to pessimism. It is necessary not to abandon the passion for ultimate truth, it declares, the eagerness to search for it or the audacity to forge new paths in the search. It is faith that stirs reason to move beyond all isolation and willingly run risks so that it may attain whatever is beautiful, good, and true. Faith cannot be seen as opposing reason, but rather, as the encyclical argues, faith thus becomes the convinced and the convincing advocate of reason. Faith inspires reason to go further than it might on its own and supports its powers. Well, in this lecture, we've seen that the interrelationship of faith and reason is complicated indeed. Augustine tackled several thorny issues and concluded that faith and reason are cooperative, not complementary in the sense that one has one realm and another has a different one, but rather that both cooperate all the time in gaining knowledge of all sorts. His views were reaffirmed in a recent encyclical that provides an inspiringly optimistic view of human abilities and potential for obtaining knowledge. Now, in our next lecture, we will turn to another fundamental issue in the science-religion relationship, namely, to what extent is God active in the natural world?